The Twilight series was a big hit both on the bestseller list and on the big screen. Now, Stephenie Meyer has another adaptation hitting area theaters, The Host. Other versions of famous books, Oz the Great and Powerful and On the Road, are currently at the movies too. I'm Russ Simmons, and on today's Central Standard Friday, the other film critics and I look at these adaptations and other films currently at Kansas City theaters. What's your favorite cinematic version of a novel? What titles just didn't work on the big screen? What book needs to be a movie that has not yet been made? Join our conversation right after this hour's news. And good morning, Kansas City, and welcome to Central Standard Friday. I'm Russ Simmons with Fox 4 and KKFI-FM. And since I'm sitting here in the host seat, that means it's movie day here on Central Standard Friday. We're going to be talking about movies that have opened up over the last month or so and playing in the Kansas City area. And just so happens that a number of those movies are adapted from novels. So we thought it might be a good topic to chat a little bit about what movies have been good that have been adapted from novels, what ones have been bad, and what ones have yet to be made. So we'd like your feedback. What movies did you like that were adapted from some of your favorite novels, or which ones missed the boat? The number is 816-235-2888. You can always contact us at centralstandard@kcur.org. And I'm joined today on the table by...
This is Loie Lockerbie, a freelance for the Kansas City Star and kcactive.com, and have a blog at suchacritic.com.
And I'm Eric Moline, a film critic for KCTV5 and scenestealers.com.
And, of course, this is the slot that was formulated and promoted by our dear colleague Walt Boudin, who passed away this week, as you all know. The memorial service is tomorrow at the Unity Temple on the plaza at 1 o'clock. I hope that you can all come to that. I would like to just give a plug really quickly right off the top here to my colleague Loie Lockerbie, who wrote a very nice piece back when Walt retired. And it was 8 Things I Learned from Walt Boudin. And we've got a link to that. You can look it up at kcur.org. Loie, do you want to just give us an overview?
Well, I did write it like a year ago. From sitting and watching him, learning about, how great a city Kansas City is, which a lot of people down or diss it and try to get away, or they leave when their career takes off. And his devotion and willingness to stay here and kind of help promote it meant a lot. Or, just not making the show too much about him, even though he was sharing his stories and... giving his take on things, he was still more interested in what everybody else had to say.
Yeah, when I was in elementary school, Walt came and spoke for our school. And so when I first got to appear on the Walt Boudin show, that was kind of awesome. That was pretty amazing.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't that aware of him. I saw him on television, but I used to listen to the show all the time. And, everybody was excited when they heard I was going to be on.
Yeah, and and Walt was a great lover of the movies. As I mentioned earlier in the week, when we were talking about Walt, that he used to go regularly, even long after he'd lost his eyesight. He would go with his friend Robert Barrientos, who would lean over and whisper in his ear, anything visual he may have missed. But he just loved the movies, and he loved going and being a part of it, because he wanted to continue to participate here on the movie critics segment of the Walt Boudin Show, which is now Central Standard Friday. We just wanted everybody to know how much we appreciated him and how much we'll miss him. So if you can show up tomorrow, that would be great. Let's go ahead and start out, since our topic is going to be about literary adaptations at the movies. We'll go ahead and start with one that opens today. It's an adaptation of a bestseller by Stephenie Meyer, who is the author of the Twilight series, and she tries to strike gold once again with The Host. Eric, do you want to take the lead on that one?
Well, actually, I haven't seen The Host.
Oh, you haven't seen
No,
The Host.
But I thought you did. I am on record as giving 2 of the Twilight movies good reviews.
Wow.
All right, Eric.
Well,
way to buck the trend.
Right. Well, actually, The Host spent 26 weeks on the bestseller list, and it was written by Myers to try to capture that same demographic, the teen and preteen girls, and I think it did that spectacularly well. And so that will be the demographic audience that will that The Host is perfect for. However, this movie is saddled with some of the lamest dialogue you can possibly imagine. This is a movie that basically, here's the plot. Some intelligent beings from outer space take over the bodies of humans. So it's sort of like Invasion of the Body Snatchers, as if reimagined by a lovesick teenage girl.
Yeah.
And so you have a love triangle, like you do in Twilight. However, two of the people in the love triangle inhabit the same body.
That's tricky.
That is tricky. And so you have this ongoing dialogue between the human and the entity that has possessed the body. And it's hilarious at times because it is absolutely silly. What could have, I suppose, worked on the page really looks ridiculous.
It doesn't seem like a cinematic thing.
No, it doesn't. And you hear Saoirse Ronan, who's a very talented actress. Probably you remember her from movies like Hannah and Adaptation. She handles it as best she can. But here are these scenes where she's having this internal dialogue, one, her possessed self and herself. And she's trying to make the other one jealous by kissing her boyfriend.
Oh my God.
It's like, give me a break.
You know what's sad about this is Andrew Niccol directed this movie. And he started off so good with Gattaca and Lord of War. And then he did that horrible Al Pacino movie, Simone, and has since just kind of been going downhill. So when I saw he was attached, I had hope, but it sounds like I shouldn't.
No. I think that as I said, the target audience will probably like it, probably appreciate it. But boy, this is, to my way of thinking, was a total misfire. Should have stayed on the page. But I'm going to be generous, I think, and I will give it 2 out of 5 stars for The Host, which... I don't know. I think some people that will see that will think I'm being just way too kind. But it does have some likable cast members, including William Hurt and Max Irons, the son of Jeremy Irons, who's quite appealing. And by the way, look quick for Evan Cleaver, who is the son of Congressman Emanuel Cleaver, who plays one of the Seekers, who is the people that are looking for the vestiges of humanity that has managed to survive this onslaught of possessions from outer space. So you'll see him as, I believe it's Seeker Pavo is his character's name. So if you want to see Emmanuel Cleaver's son, that's him. So that's The Host. It's rated PG to appeal to that teen and preteen audience. And we'll be talking about other literary adaptations as we go along, but we want to bring Paul into the conversation from Brookside. Hi, Paul.
Phil.
Oh, Phil, excuse me. Phil, welcome aboard.
Quite all right, thanks. I always thought that George Roy Hill's adaptation of The World According to Garp actually not only was as good, it was probably better than the book. They cut out a lot of extraneous stuff that I thought the book meandered a little bit and just tightened things up. And it was just phenomenal.
I totally agree, and there were some spectacular performances in that movie.
Absolutely. Robin Williams probably more restrained than he has been in some movies.
For sure.
Most movies, yeah.
Saying a little. The other thing I wanted to talk about was books that should be produced into a movie.
Yeah.
And one that is not, that I've heard is on one of the top 10 lists of unproduced screenplays, is Childhood's End by Arthur C. Clarke.
Oh, sure.
It keeps, somebody gets it, nothing happens, over and over. It's been through like 3 or 4 pre-productions and never produced.
You know, it's impossible to figure out the machinations of Hollywood and how these things get done, but it's almost remarkable that anything ever gets done.
Absolutely.
Is it a tricky novel to adapt, do you think, or is it something else?
Yes, because without really trying to give away too much, you lose the main character in the first quarter of the book.
That's bad.
Yeah.
Brian Palma did it. Dressed to Kill.
It's quite a shocker, but then, you know, the book does make sense as it goes on. But
Hey, thanks, Phil. Really appreciate your call.
You take care.
All right, you too. Let's go ahead and move ahead to another literary adaptation. Lloyd, would you take the lead on a movie called Admission?
Yeah, this is based on a book by Jean Hamm Horowitz, I think is her name. And it's about a Princeton admissions officer played by Tina Fey, who is perfect at her job, basically. And her life is very controlled. She was raised by this really over-the-top freewheeling mother played by Lily Tomlin, and she's sort of slingshotted the other direction and become this very proper perfectionist. But she goes to visit this alternative school up in the woods run by Paul Rudd, and he's got this kid who's basically a prodigy, and she becomes very attached to the kid, especially when she finds out that he might be the son she gave up for adoption back when she was in college. And she kind of melts down at that point, as Tina Fey can better than just about anybody. I won't say that it's a great film by any means. It's very cliched. Not much really happens necessarily. You always kind of know where it's headed. But you've got Tina Fey, you've got Paul Rudd, Lily Tomlin, Michael Sheen. Really, you couldn't ask for a better cast. Wallace Shawn is in it. And they're all great. And they're proof that maybe great actors can't save bad material, but they can save mediocre material. And, you know, I still found it entertaining just watching them all play off each other and do their thing.
Yes.
So, I could give it a 3.
I'm right there with you. I would agree that it's worth a 3. You know, this is directed by Paul Weitz, who did About a Boy, which was an outstanding comic drama. And the only thing that he let get away a little bit is the pacing, because I felt the pacing on the film was off.
Drags a little bit.
It does. Yeah. I love Tina Fey and homeboy Paul Rudd from Overland Park. He's terrific in this movie, as is everyone in the cast. Lily Tomlin, as you mentioned. It's very light fare. Don't go in expecting very much. But it's a sweet-natured movie that isn't as satirical as most of Tina Fey's material in the past. This is more of a character for her. She did not write it. She was strictly an actress in this film. But I thought she did a good job, and it was a likable movie, and I'm going to give it 3 stars as well. Let's move ahead and talk about another movie that opened back on March 15th, The Incredible Burt Wonderstone. And incidentally, you are listening to Central Standard Friday here on KCUR. And join the conversation at 816-235-2888. And Eric, do you want to tell us about The Incredible Burt Wonderstone?
I suppose. I'll make it brief. The Incredible Burt Wonderstone, I pulled out the rating on my website that I rarely use, which is the Swiss Fist, Complete Neutrality. The last movie I gave complete neutrality to was Rush Hour 3. So if that gives you any, like, you don't hate it. There's really not necessarily that much wrong with it. It just lies there, and it's fairly entertaining while you're watching it, and you forget it the moment you leave the theater. The Incredible Burt Wonderstone stars Steve Carell and Steve Buscemi as Las Vegas magicians, illusionists, and Jim Carrey as a rival. He is the Chris Angel, David Blaine style of street magician. Jim Carrey is way over the top and pretty funny in most of the scenes that he's in. And then you have the other two who are like kind of the Siegfried and Roy or Lance Burton or David Copperfield type. And this material, it just feels like it should have been made about 10 years ago. And it turns out that the script has been around for about 8 years. So that would have been a possibility. But Steve Carell just really isn't able to do much with this role. Olivia Wilde is in it as his girlfriend or almost girlfriend. She starts out as kind of a sidekick to him. And there's a moment in the film where he goes from being this really selfish person to being a person who's learned his lesson. And that moment happens in 1 second. He turns on a dime. And it's like it's one of those comedies where the actors, like you said, Loie, before, are elevating the material and making it a little bit better. But there's really not that much to work with except for a very, very funny ending. And sometimes when you have a great ending, you walk out of the theater with a big smile on your face and you forget that for the last 90 minutes you were kind of, you know, alternately bored and faintly amused. So the Swiss Fist, 2.5 out of 5 stars for The Incredible Burt Wonderstone.
See, and I'd go a 3 on this because I kind of felt the same way about it that I did about Admission. I love the cast. I'm not a Jim Carrey fan, and honestly, I think they could have cut his character out entirely, and it would have been pretty much the same film.
Wow.
But I adore Steve Carell. Nobody can play sympathetic losers better than he can. And Steve Buscemi is great when he does comedy. He doesn't do it often enough. Olivia Wilde actually got my interest. Normally, I couldn't care less about her, but she was funny in this. And Alan Arkin is in it, too, and, you know, he's always going to be fun to have around. So it's another example of a movie where the material's kind of eh, but you have people in it who bring it up a little bit and give you something at least amusing to watch. So I feel the same way. That and Admission could be a double bill of sort of slightly elevated mediocrity, I suppose. So 3 stars.
Yeah, you know, Steve Carell does, as you say, what he can with this role. But every word out of his mouth, as I was listening to it, I thought this was written for Will Ferrell. Because this is a Will Ferrell character, the egotistical, clueless guy who doesn't realize he's a jerk until, you know, much later in the film where he has the epiphany and he realizes he's been wrong. That's the role that Will Ferrell has played over and over and over again in all of his comedies. And even down to the dialogue, it sounded like Will Ferrell. And I'm thinking, I wonder if somewhere along the line he had to drop out and they got Steve Carell to come in there. But that said, I think you're right, Lo. I think the cast is likable enough. It's amusing enough. It's complete piffle. But at the same time, you know, if you're there for a few minor laughs, you might enjoy it. I'll give it a 3. And since we have 3 and 3 and 2.5, so shall we say 3, Eric?
I guess so.
All right. And yeah. You wanted to add another note.
Well, I just wanted to say that there's really 2 halves of the film. And the first half is this really hard kind of character that Steve Carell is playing before the turn where he gets sympathetic. And that could have been like really biting satire, or it could have been something like Zoolander, where the character is so dumb that he never grows. And I kind of wish they would have committed to that instead of having the moment where everything gets sympathetic and it becomes kind of formula. So I think it could have grown a pair and really, you know, done something with it. But, you know.
Yeah, I agree. And you're completely right. We're not far apart on this one. So that's 3 for The Incredible Burt Wonderstone, rated PG-13. Another movie that opened on March 15th is a thriller called The Call. Loie, could you fill us in on that one?
Well, The Call is the latest effort by Halle Berry to make everyone forget she won an Oscar. And it's not that she's bad in it. It's just that, you know, there's not much there. She plays a 911 operator in Los Angeles who overhears the kidnapping of a teenage girl and can't do anything for her. It's all over before the police can get there, and the girl ends up getting killed. And about, I think it's 6 months later, it gets another call from another young girl who's being kidnapped and as eventually begins to realize it's the same guy. And the interesting thing in the film is the way that they show the process of trying to track where this girl is and where the guy's taking her and who he is, and using various technologies at their disposal and some good old-fashioned, you know, on-your-feet detective work, trying to kind of figure out what's going on and give her ways to survive and let people know what's happening. That part is interesting, and that's about, I don't know, maybe the middle third of the movie. But especially towards the end, it just gets into classic idiot plot behavior of just things that anyone with a tiny bit of sense would never do, and yet these supposedly intelligent and brave people are right there doing them. And it kind of goes on like that long enough where you think, oh, God, you know, it's another one of these. It's another one of these dumb thrillers that doesn't make any sense. And, you know, you get your little thrill at the end. But honestly, aside from the bits where they're, you know, trying to track the cell phone or telling the girl ways to get attention and that sort of thing, that's kind of interesting. The rest of it is just completely a wash. And, you know, I don't know what Halle Berry's thinking half the time with her career choices, but she hasn't been making very good ones. So I'd have to give this a 2.
You know, we're not too far apart on this one as well, except I really pretty much did enjoy the first 2/3 of this film. Mm-hmm. I thought it was tense. I thought it was interesting. And seeing the behind-the-scenes action at the 911 call center is kind of interesting. Abigail Breslin, I thought, acquitted herself very nicely as the victim who gets locked in the trunk and tries desperately to escape. And Halle Berry giving her instructions on what to do. I found that all very interesting and intense. Where I thought it went wrong is when Halle Berry left the call center and decided to take matters into her own hands. And you think, oh, come on, that's where credibility just gets thrown completely out the window. And then it has one of those endings that seemed like it was completely tacked on, that seemed like it was an afterthought. Well, we got to have some kind of a climax that will make it more appealing to the audience, and it just stretches credibility to the limit. So I had mixed feelings about it. I will probably give it a 2.5. So are you willing to go to 2.5 for the call?
Okay, sure.
Okay, great.
For that middle sequence, I'll go up a little bit.
We have Michael from Fairway on the phone, who also has something to say about the call. Hi, Michael.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure.
You know what the call reminded me of, because I saw it briefly, and then I was trying to think, gosh, right, I've seen this before. And I realized it's just like the taking of Pelham 1-2-3 with Denzel Washington and John Travolta. And it's kind of like shocked that I realized, like, I'm sure those people saw that movie and saw that you really can't get too great of a film when you're at a call center and you're trying to, like, you know, create drama. And just like the call, you know, Denzel eventually leaves the call center, and then that's when they have to force everything to happen.
That's a good point.
Yeah,
you know, I do see
true.
The parallels. I hadn't thought of it before, but you're right. By the way, did you ever see the original Taking of Pelham 1-2-3 from the 70s?
No, I am sorry. That was 20 years before I was born, so
okay.
I'm trying to catch up on films from that era. So.
It's much better than the remake, I must tell you. It's really very tense and original, and I think if you do go back and catch that one, the original version, that you'll see the difference, and you'll, I think, appreciate it probably more than the version that came out, what, about 5 years ago?
Mm.
Thanks for calling, Michael. Appreciate your input. And we want you to call us as well at 816-235-2888. We're talking about movies that have opened up over the last month or so, as well as literary adaptations of movies. What's worked? What hasn't worked? What needs to be made? We want to hear from you. You can also contact us at centralstandard@kcur.org. Let's go ahead and talk about another picture that has opened. Let's see. It was back on March 8th. It's another literary adaptation that is absolutely burning up the box office. It's Oz the Great and Powerful. Eric?
Yeah, Oz the Great and Powerful is a literary adaptation in that it uses some of the characters and locations from L. Frank Baum's early books in the Oz series. And, of course, The Wizard of Oz being the most famous adaptation of that. This is imagined, or reimagined, I suppose, as a sort of prequel to that film, with James Franco playing the young magician who comes from a carnival in Kansas and is then transplanted through a hot air balloon and another storm into the land of Oz. And basically, Franco is barely treading water in this film, trying to breathe some life into this role. Actually, he doesn't. I feel like he really was just kind of sleepwalking through it. But the real magic in the film comes from director Sam Raimi, who's known for the first three Spider-Man movies, the Evil Dead movies. And he has this kind of joy with the way that he has his style of visual storytelling. And I feel like there's many, many scenes in this film that are just full of great visuals and exciting magic. It is a little bit bogged down by an excessive amount of CGI, but that's also kind of part and parcel of the design of the film. I also think that Michelle Williams is very good as Glinda the Good Witch. And,
I agree.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, for me, she kind of sold the film. Her and Rachel Weisz really sold the whole fairy tale version. It seems like they were playing a heightened version of reality while James Franco was playing like he would today. And so it was a weird mix. But overall, I think there's enough good in this film to go see it. And honestly, for me, it's one of the few movies I've seen recently that I thought were very exciting in 3D.
You know, let's start out with what's really good. And that's the visual elements and the 3D, which are downright spectacular. Now, I think you and I both saw it at the Extreme Screen at Union Station, correct?
Yes.
They have completely revamped that facility. The picture and sound quality are stupendous. I guess my only criticism is sometimes they crank the volume up a little too loud. Other than that, boy, this is the place to see a good 3D movie. And the visual effects in this one are really spectacular.
Especially the porcelain girl, China girl.
Oh, absolutely.
Wow.
Yeah, it's really cool. But that's the good part. The bad part is James Franco. You know, he is an outstanding actor, can be. But you're right. He is just completely listless and miscast in this movie. He was just absolutely picking up a paycheck. There's absolutely no spark, no charisma. This is a character that should be, you know, really engaging. It's sort of like Johnny Depp would have been perfect. Maybe even Robert Downey Jr. Somebody like that who has that kind of personality they can bring to bear. Unfortunately, James Franco just did not fill the bill. That said, I still found it very entertaining in spite of itself. It's, you know, as I say, it's got the visual elements that work. As you mentioned, Michelle Williams is luminous in this role. And it's got a lot of action. And the I think the kids will enjoy it. A little too long, perhaps. But I found it entertaining. So I'm probably going to give it a 3.5. And you give it a 3?
Yes.
So, okay, we'll say three for Oz the Great and Powerful. Not really a literary adaptation, but in a way it sort of is. We're going to be taking a break very soon, but I want to remind everybody that we're talking about literary adaptations, and we want you to give us a call at 816-235-2888 or send us a note at centralstandard@kcur.org and let us know what's worked for you, what hasn't, and perhaps what needs to be made that hasn't been made yet. And we'll be talking about some things going on movie-wise in the Kansas City area coming up after the break. In the meantime, we're going to take a short break and we'll be back in just a little bit. And welcome back to Central Standard Friday. I'm Russ Simmons, and this is Movie Day here on Central Standard Friday, talking about movies that have come out over the last month or so. And in particular, we're talking about literary adaptations. So if there's a book that's been made into a movie that you liked, let us know about it. If there's one you hated, let us know about that as well. If there's one that needs to be made, let us know about that at 816-235-2888. We have a few announcements before we pick up the ball and continue to run. First of all, some of the important news. The Kansas City Film Fest is taking place April 10th through the 14th at the Alamo Drafthouse Main Street. You can find out more information at kcur.org. The Tivoli Cinemas continues its Science Fiction Master Classics with Dr. Strangelove on Thursday, the 24th of April at 7, and Eyes Without a Face on Tuesday, April 9th at 7 p.m. And also the free movie series at the library continues, and there's a number of musical films that are touching on the subject of music that the library is going to be showing over the next few weeks. One of them is The Commitments. That's going to be at the Central Library. 8 Mile, the Eminem movie, at the Lucille Bluford Branch. Martin Scorsese presents The Blues. Episode 1 is going to be a double bill with Say Amen, Somebody, the gospel film. And that's going to be April 2nd at the Plaza Branch. Leadbelly on April 6th at the Central Library. And you can find out more information again at kcur.org. And our colleague Robert Butler continues his 20 Films Essential to Cinema Literacy series. And Wings of Desire is going to be Sunday, April 7th at 1:30 at the Plaza Branch. Our colleagues over at the Screenland, they're going to be continuing their Screenland Cheap Shots roasts. And they're going to be giving the lampoon to Anaconda and The Room. And that's tonight, March 29th, 8 p.m. at the Screenland Crossroads. And finally, Cinemark Classic Series, the digitally restored classic films playing both at the Merriam and Plaza Cinemark Theaters, Casablanca on April 3rd, and Godfather. It's also coming up. So if you want to find out more about times, places, shows, everything I've just talked about, just go to kcur.org. And Eric, I believe you have some announcements too.
Yeah. Well, one of the things during the Kansas City Film Fest is a movie called Bronies, the extremely unexpected adult fans of My Little Pony. And this is the highest grossing Kickstarter project of all time, or at least it was until the Veronica Mars movie last week. There's a Q&A with filmmaker Michael Brockhoff and John Delancey, who is executive producer and also star of the film. He is Q on Star Trek The Next Generation.
How did he get involved in this?
He is one of the voices of the characters on My Little Pony. And I'm actually going to be hosting and doing the Q&A. It's 7:15 p.m., April 11th, and co-sponsored by the Social Media Club of Kansas City. The Free State Film Festival in Lawrence is coming up April 26th through the 28th at the Lawrence Arts Center. Last year they had Compliance, which was pretty awesome. And this year they've got This Is Martin Bonner, an Audience Award winner at Sundance, Dave Grohl's Sound City, and Small Apartments, produced in part by local firm Andrews McMeel. Also, Film School at the Alamo Drafthouse tomorrow, hosted by my colleague Trey Hawk at Scene Stealers, is showing True Stories, the David Byrne movie, which for the first time people will actually be able to see in widescreen because it's only been available in VHS and DVD in full screen. So, and then also tomorrow night, I am hosting Air Guitar Nation, which is a documentary that inspired me to enter the world of competitive air guitar. So it's very personal to me, at the Alamo Drafthouse at 9:30, followed by a message from one of the film's stars, Bjorn to Rock. And then we're going to turn it into a rock and roll party and have video air guitar karaoke following the film.
I love it. And you can find out all of this information at KCUR.org. Is that
yes.
right? Okay, very good. We're talking about cinematic adaptations of books, and we have a full lineup of people that want to chat about that. So let's go ahead and jump in and talk to Bill, who wants to tell us about Oz. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Well, first of all, I wanted you mentioned that it would have been perfect for Johnny Depp or Robert Downey Jr. It's been published in the newspapers that they both turned down the part.
And it would have been much better with one of them.
Well, I'm sort of over Johnny Depp, but I can Robert Downey Jr. I support. But at any rate, the other thing is you ask about movies that ought to be made, and everybody ought to get on the web and pound Broadway to make the Broadway show The Boy from Oz into a film. That was Hugh Jackman playing Peter Allen, probably the most exciting live performer ever, and the late Peter Allen. And so that ran on Broadway for a while, but I don't think there was ever a road company of it. So I think they ought to grab Hugh Jackman while he's on a musical roll and get him to play Peter Allen.
I think that there's actually a movie production of Wicked that's in the works right now. Actually.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Well, this one is called The Boy from Oz.
Right.
Hey, and thanks. It was a big deal. Okay, well, that's it.
I appreciate it, Bill. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. Bye.
We also have Donna from Shawnee, who's read all of the Oz books. Is that right?
Yes, it is. And I was hoping they had the good sense to include the woggle bug from book two.
Didn't see that.
No. Oh, no, because he's highly magnified and thoroughly educated. Those books are amazing. It's really such a snapshot of history of over 100 years ago. So I just wanted to mention that.
Have you happened to have seen any of the other Oz films besides The Wizard of Oz?
No, I actually have a couple of them in my queue, and I haven't seen them yet. They're actually, I think, silent ones. Are there others?
Well, I know the silent series tends to follow the books more closely than any of the other adaptations that I'm aware of.
Then there's also Return to Oz, which was from 1985 or 86, directed by Walter Murch, who was the one of the editors for Coppola on Apocalypse Now. This is the only movie he ever directed, Return to Oz. And then, of course, The Wiz with Diana Ross and Michael Jackson singing their way through New York.
Yeah, that was pretty good, too. Okay.
Thanks for your call. Disappointed.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm,
bye.
You bet. Let's go to Dennis in Excelsior Springs. He has a favorite that he'd like to talk about. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. My favorite adaptation would be Moby Dick, the 1956 movie with Gregory Peck.
Right.
Greatest. Actually, it's my favorite movie of all movies.
Wow.
And the screenwriter was Ray Bradbury, and supposedly, he had never read the book. He just knew the gist.
Wow.
Wasn't that directed by John Huston?
Well, that I wouldn't know. But the movie, it's one of those movies that, in my opinion, is far better than the novel.
Wow.
Oh.
That's saying something.
That's a big talk right there.
Hey, thanks so much, Dennis. Appreciate your call. And next, we're going to go to, that's Suzanne. Oh, yeah, excuse me, wrong button. There you go. Suzanne from Leawood, welcome aboard.
Well, hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I want to tell you about one of my very favorite movies is The French Lieutenant's Woman. And when I first read this novel, it has two endings. It's set in Victoria, England, and it has two endings, and one ending is about hope, and the other ending is about despair. And so when I found the movie coming out, I thought, boy, how are they going to handle those two endings? And the screenwriting is terribly clever. The one ending is between two actors making the movie.
Right.
And their love affair. And then the other ending is the from the movie itself about the Victorian couple that are from the original novel. And it's just extremely clever the way the whole thing is done. And it's a very seductive movie anyway. It's filmed in Lyme, England, and it has all those English manners and, you know, all that duplicity
right.
You know, one kind of moral code for men and the other moral code for women, et cetera. And, so just a brilliant movie.
And a couple of tremendous performances from Meryl Streep and Jeremy Irons as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And just it's just gorgeous in every single way.
Hey, thank you, Suzanne. Appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
And we're going to go now to Brent from Kansas City, Missouri. Brent, what do you have
Hello.
To tell us?
Well, one of the worst, I have two movies, the worst adaptation from a book I ever saw was Starship Troopers by Robert Heinlein.
That's one of my favorites. One of my favorites of
See,
all time.
I did not like that movie.
Yeah.
I mean, the movie is totally misses so much of the book. I mean,
it doesn't miss it. It on purpose is satirizing it, I think.
The book was somewhat satirical itself, I thought. But and then the other book that was not a bad just the book and the movie were so divergent was Planet of the Apes.
Yes. But it was still a good movie.
I don't understand in the book, you know, they're on a different planet. They go back to Earth, and they find out the same thing has happened to Earth.
Right.
And to me, I love the movie, but I'd like to see someone make the book.
Yeah, good point. All right, thanks.
I think it would be a very interesting book, or movie.
Yeah, appreciate it, Brent.
Thank you.
You bet. Now we're going to go to Mark in Olathe. Hi, Mark. Welcome aboard.
Thanks for having me.
Sure.
1982, a movie came out, an adaptation of a John Steinbeck novel. The movie starred Deborah Winger and Nick Nolte. Can you guys guess what it is?
Is it Cannery Row?
Cannery Row, yeah. And the reason I'm calling is I think that movie is just as good as the book, which was wonderful. They managed to catch the feel of the ambience of the place and the time, and the characters that they played in the movie were as great as the characters depicted in the writing.
I have never seen that, but on your recommendation, I'm going to check that out.
Highly recommend it. Quick question.
Sure.
I read the book Fight Club and swore that I would never watch a movie of it if they made a movie. I'm guessing you guys have seen the movie, and do you know if it does the book justice?
Yeah,
I haven't
good.
Read the book, but the movie is fantastic. So I recommend it regardless of whether it follows the book closely or not.
Yeah, directed by David Fincher, who's one of the best in the business.
Fair enough. The book was completely awesome, and so much so that I couldn't see how anybody could adapt it for the screen, and told myself I wasn't going to watch the movie at the time.
Hey, thanks a lot. Go ahead.
One last comment. A movie I haven't seen yet either, but I did read the book. Maybe you can comment on that, is Life of Pi.
Oh, I thought the movie – that was my favorite movie
it was mine too. It is absolutely spectacular, although you may have missed your chance to see it in the optimum conditions, which is on a big screen in 3D, but I have a suspicion it's probably pretty spectacular regardless. So
yeah, I've watched it at home since, and it still holds up. It's just great, great storytelling.
Appreciate it, Mark.
Thank you so much.
You bet. Talking now to Carrie from Kansas City, Missouri, who has a favorite adaptation. What is it, Carrie?
It is The Devil Wears Prada, and I completely agree with you that the cast or the actors that play the different roles can really take something that's either mediocre, so-so, good, and take it to the next or two or three levels up. And I think in this, a perfect example of that is Meryl Streep and she can just like purse her lips and completely communicate what that character is thinking.
Well, yeah. Meryl Streep can do no wrong in my
true.
Book.
Yeah, and I actually I've read both the book and seen the movie, and I think the movie is better than the book because in the movie you've got all the visuals and the clothes and all the other stuff that's part of this whole industry really becomes like another character, and you can't really get that as much in the book since it's all printed on a page.
Thanks so much, Carrie. Appreciate your call.
Fun show. Thanks a lot.
You bet. And now we're going to talk to John from Pleasant Valley, who has an adaptation he wants to chat about. Hi, John.
Yes. First, I want to mention my agreement that The Life of Pi was an excellent adaptation of the book. I often read books before I see the movies, and I'm often disappointed, at least initially, with the adaptation, although many times later when I see the movie again, I realize, well, that really was a pretty good adaptation. But one movie I want to mention that I saw the movie form first was Mr. Roberts with Henry Fonda, and later I bought the book at a garage sale or something, and I read it, and I was astounded in how good the adaptation was. That book is pretty short, and the screenplay took whole lines of dialogue verbatim out of one scene and put them into other scenes, and yet the movie hangs together as a whole. I was very impressed after reading the book with the job they had done on the adaptation.
I agree. I enjoyed that movie very much. Unusual topic for a John Ford movie.
Yes, indeed, and a very fine film. And I never, you know, when I've seen Mr. Roberts since then, after having read the book, I'm constantly astounded at how they took the material that was in the book, which was a little disorganized, frankly, and turned it into a well-organized thing that that really communicated a lot.
Hey, thanks a lot, John. Appreciate the call.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Danny writes on Twitter that the best film adaptation of written works were Brokeback Mountain, mm-hmm. Lord of the Rings trilogy, and the Harry Potter films. They matched how I pictured them. And Benton on Twitter writes, Into the Wild was great as a book and as a movie. And Jim called in to say that his favorite adaptation was Little Big Man, the Western with Dustin Hoffman, which was a very good film. Eric, on the other hand, writes that one of his least favorite adaptation was Peter Jackson's version of The Hobbit. I wonder if he actually read the book. I think he did.
Yeah, and he also read a lot of external material, too, which is where a lot of it's coming from. But that really speaks to the whole point of we're talking about adaptation.
Right.
You people sometimes complain, oh, it wasn't just like the book. Well, it can't be and it shouldn't be.
Yeah.
Sometimes the best thing you can do is make changes. And, you know, it depends on what you're dealing with and how cinematic it is to begin with. But, you're talking about two very, very different mediums.
You're listening to Central Standard Friday here on KCUR. You can call us at 816-235-2888. Or send us a note at centralstandard@kcur.org. Quickly, I wanted to get a couple of other titles in before we get back to the calls. So, Loie, tell us a little bit about Happy People.
This is Werner Herzog's latest documentary. He goes to central Siberia, to this very remote village that's populated by about 300 people. Most of the men are professional trappers. And it follows the cycle of a year in this village, watching them make their own skis and their own boats, setting up cabins out in this vast forest, and, you know, just how they live off the land because there's almost no contact with the outside world and very little modern technology. And it is very slow in places, and they do have this – Herzog over-narrates the heck out of this thing. I mean, he just describes what you're seeing on the screen half the time. And they have actors dubbing over the voices instead of just having subtitles, and they're not very good actors. So those things are a little distracting. I almost wish that they had just cut out most of the extraneous sound and put up some subtitles and let these guys speak for themselves because it's a fascinating glimpse into a world that – it's completely alien to most of us.
And what would your rating be?
I'd give it probably 3.5.
3.5 for Happy People, which is not rated. I also wanted to talk really quickly about another literary adaptation, On the Road, based on Jack Kerouac's book.
Yeah, absolutely. This opens this weekend. Stars Kristen Stewart, Garrett Hedlund. And this is obviously, if you've read Jack Kerouac's book, On the Road, it's a sprawling kind of a book. It doesn't really have a plot. It's really about these these people who are kind of rebelling against society, and they want to find their own meaning and their own philosophies in life by just kind of hitting the road and seeing what happens, and responsibilities be damned. Walter Salles is an incredible filmmaker. He made Central Station, which is a great movie from many years ago, and also The Motorcycle Diaries. I think he does the best that he can with this material. I think it's really not, like Loie said, it's a very different art form, and the movies are not made for a film like this that is essentially plotless, but Garrett Hedlund is really great in it, and I think he's got a lot of charisma, and if you're a Kerouac or a Beat Generation fan, this is definitely worth seeing. So I'll give it 3 out of 5.
And I didn't like it as well as you did. I think that there's some things that don't translate well to the screen. We don't get Kerouac's prose, which is really the attraction from the book. So what we get is what plays out to me like home movies. I thought I liked the cast. Time and place was captured nicely, but otherwise I found it disappointing. I'll give it a 2. So 2.5, is that what we said for? You said 3, mm-hmm. Right? Okay, 2.5 for On the Road. I want to very quickly try to get a few more calls in. We just have a short period of time left, but let's go to Roger from Wyandotte. Hi, Roger.
Hi. I guess the biggest two disappointments I had after reading the book were Clockers and Another Day in Paradise. Those were such gritty novels, dark, and Hollywood overproduced them and, just made them almost syrupy. They were way overacted. It was hugely disappointing to me, at least.
Which is interesting, because that's Spike Lee and Larry Clark, who aren't really known as Hollywood directors. So
right,
yeah.
And to me, the casting was wrong. The way they went, approached the character is in each one of them. They were damaged people, and they didn't bring that through. The book brought it, and it showed it. It didn't bring it in either one of the movies.
Thanks a lot, Roger. Appreciate your call. Let's go to Dale in Overland Park. Hi, Dale.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
One of the best adaptations that I think I have ever seen, this is a little bit of an older film, is The Lord of the Flies from back in the late 80s, early 90s, I think it was,
mm-hmm.
when that came out, the adaptation of Golding's dystopian novel. I was going to say, then the one that I would really love to see adapted is Hilary Jordan's first novel, Mudbound.
I don't know that.
It's a story about this woman who is a sharecropper's wife in post-World War II and on this farm in Mississippi, and involves racial tension and just an interpersonal romance triangle type suggestions. And just really tightly drawn. I think it'd be a great, great novel to tell.
Okay, thanks a lot, Dale. Appreciate it. Let's now go to Michael in Fairway. Hi, Michael.
Hi, thanks for having me again. I wanted to make a brief comment. I saw someone said about The Hobbit being a bad adaptation. I like one film professor I saw from that I saw opinion on it, is that I don't think Peter Jackson will ever admit it, but I'm pretty sure he wants to create his own two trilogies that rival George Lucas and Star Wars.
Okay, I think that's fair enough.
Yeah, he's on his way to improving on the prequels anyway.
I mean, that's part of it, but I think he said, put it like, he's really trying to tie it all together very slowly. But it's just a way, you could divide The Hobbit into two parts if you wanted, but a trilogy with that book,
it's a stretch.
Pretty much gives away that he wants to create.
Adding a lot of material. Yes. Yeah.
Ka-ching, that's what I say to that. Thanks, Michael. Appreciate your call.
I appreciate it. Thanks.
Okay. Hi, Frank from Lawrence. Welcome aboard.
Hi. My favorite movie adaptation is Being There with Peter Sellers.
Oh, yeah.
The Kaczynski novel. It's probably Peter Sellers' most understated role, but it's great.
Yeah, I thought he was outstanding in that. Yeah, and Shirley MacLaine as well.
Yes. And now another one that was excellent was Slaughterhouse-Five, the Kurt Vonnegut novel.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was good as well.
Very hallucinatory, surrealistic kind of thing. So it probably worked better in a movie than in a book for many people.
Hey, thanks a lot, Frank. Appreciate your call.
It's a tough adaptation, Slaughterhouse-Five.
Scott writes on Facebook that Hearts in Atlantis by Stephen King was a horrible movie compared to the book. C'est la vie. It's been a mixed bag for Stephen King adaptations, that is for sure. They've been very good and they've been very bad. So Hollywood has had a very spotty history with Stephen King adaptations. I did want to throw in very quickly a plug for Gatekeepers, which I think is an excellent documentary. It's about the Shin Bet, the Secret Service agency in Israel that is fighting terrorism, and they interview six heads of the Shin Bet in this documentary, and it's a fascinating behind-the-scenes look, and it's also very sad in the way that we examine this seemingly intractable problem.
Yeah, this is about the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, and over all of these decades of these guys being in charge, they come forth, they're very frank, and the bottom line is, after watching this film, is they all feel like it was all for nothing, and that is just brutal.
Yeah, I'm going to give it a 4. How about you?
Yeah, exactly.
4 for Gatekeepers, and let's also talk about Stoker.
Stoker is my favorite movie in theaters right now. This is Park Chan-wook, or Chan-wook Park, depending on how you pronounce order the name. But this is the guy who did Old Boy and the Vengeance trilogy. It's his first American film. Nicole Kidman, Mia Wasikowska, and Matthew Good. It's a gothic southern thriller. It's twisted, it's wicked, and it's nasty, and I loved it.
And your rating?
4 out of 5.
I'm going to give it a 3, so we'll say 3.5 for Stoker, rated R. Scott writes on Facebook, Hearts and Lance. Oh, we said that. Sue from Texas called in to say Hunt for Red October is her favorite adaptation. Obviously, we had a lot of calls, a lot of feedback on this, so this is a topic that we will revisit sometime in the not-too-distant future. I want to thank you for listening to Central Standard Friday here on KCUR. Don't forget the tribute to Walt Bodine tomorrow, 1 o'clock at the Unity Temple on the Plaza. And I want to thank my fellow film critics, Lori Lockerbie and Eric Moline.
Thanks.
Have a great day.